Greetings, comrade. Welcome to Radio Podcast. We have taken over. It's good to be good communist in Virginia as we get in good representation and people doing good things in government, taking guns and from the capitalist pigs. Hey, Ivan, whoa, what do you think you're doing? I'm taking over radio show. No. This is my radio show. No, there's no my anymore. There's no personal property. We have taken over. Not yet, you haven't. The Patriots in Virginia haven't quite gotten up. Beat it. Well, okay, but I'll be back. Oh, sorry about that, everybody. Can we kill the music? Kill the music. Okay, this is ridiculous. Ivan won't be back. Not if I or any of you have anything to say about it. This is Patriots only. Capitalists only. Freedom-loving Americans only. And the communists can go die in a ditch where they belong. And we got a lot of crazy stuff going on in Virginia. Tonight I'll be talking about civil disobedience. I'll be making the case for it through history, through the Bible. And I'll be talking about the doctrine of the lesser magistrate. As well, I'll be going over some current news. And I'll be highlighting a couple of important bills that you should know about. Just giving the bill numbers and the titles of these bills, because it's not just gun issues that the communists in Richmond are trying to bombard us with. There's a lot of other bad stuff. And I'll be closing out the show talking about Lobby Day and what you can expect this year. This is Hank Reardon, and this is Radio Free Virginia. And you can find us online at radiofreeva.com, as well as the Podbean player. That's where we're uploading this podcast. You can listen on our website. Find us on Facebook as well. Just search for Radio Free Virginia. Always love to get comments and updates from all of you. If you see a bill, this is one of the best ways that I find out about stuff is people sending me messages or texts or lots of other things. There's a lot of eyeballs out there watching things, and it really helps when if you see something crazy, you send it to me. So let's get started.
In recognizing a communist, physical appearance counts for nothing. If he openly declares himself to be a communist, we take his word for it. If a person consistently reads and advocates the views expressed in a communist publication, he may be a communist. If a person supports organizations which reflect communist teachings, or organizations labeled communist by the Department of Justice, she may be a communist. If a person defends the activities of communist nations while consistently attacking the domestic and foreign policy of the United States, she may be a communist. If a person does all these things over a period of time, he must be a communist. But there are other communists who don't show their real faces, who work more silently.
Special thanks to John Jacob over at Radio Free Redoubt for that clip and a bunch of others which I'll be sharing in the weeks to come. I love old-timey radio, but I especially love good, wholesome, anti-communist propaganda. Good stuff. Came across this quote from somebody on Facebook. They had wrote this. I'll give them the codename Juliet. Citing ultra-liberal judges in other states that allowed legislation like this to stand hardly makes it constitutional. It would be blatantly un-American of us to give in. It would be blatantly un-American of us to comply, get rid of, register, or turn over any guns or gear. It would be blatantly un-American of us not to respond in self-defense against an obviously tyrannical dictatorship. When they start using force and violence to carry out or enforce these blatantly unconstitutional laws, they want this. They are forcing this. No more infringement, no more compromise. Don't take this out of context. I am hardly advocating violence or making a first move or doing anything stupid like that. If you are attacked by an obviously tyrannical dictatorship that is supposed to adhere to the guidelines of the Constitution, but doesn't, it is your duty as an American to defend yourself. Now is, however, the time to start planning what we do next. Organizing protests in front of these anti-American houses, all at the same time across the state, making their neighbors hate them, hiring private detectives to look into these people's lives and come up with any incriminating dirt that we can use against them. Start getting with your neighbors and members of this group in your counties and lay out some type of contingency plan if it does hit the fan. How will you contact each other? Where will you go? What will you do? How will you contact others in other counties, etc.? No more compromise. When I read this, I thought of Alexander Solzhenitsyn. I have this book, The Gulag Archipelago. It's a tough read. I've gotten through maybe the first chapter. It's tough. I mean, it's pretty heavy stuff. When you read it, you think, gosh, the misery that those people were under. And he wrote this, "Oh, how we burned in the camps later, thinking, what would things have been like if every security operative, when he went out at night to make an arrest, had been uncertain whether he would return alive and had to say goodbye to his family? Or if, during periods of mass arrests, as for example in Leningrad, when they arrested a quarter of the entire city, people had not simply sat there in their lairs, pawing with terror at every bang of the downstairs door and every step on the staircase, but had understood that they had nothing left to lose and had boldly set up in the downstairs hall an ambush of half a dozen people with axes, hammers, pokers, or whatever else was at hand. The organs would very quickly have suffered a shortage of officers and transport, and notwithstanding of all of Stalin's threats, the cursed machine would have ground to a halt. If. We didn't love freedom enough. And even more, we had no awareness of the real situation. We purely and simply deserved everything that happened afterward." So I think that quote, and the one before it, is a perfect segue into the concept of civil disobedience. You know, what do we mean by civil disobedience? I mean at all levels, whether it's just non-compliance, or whether it's physical action or physical force. Do we as Americans, do we as Christians, do we as human beings have the right to do this, to rebel against our government? Well, let's look at the way this country was founded, the American Revolution. And this is from Wall Builders. And this is pretty long, but there's a lot of really good information here. And it's titled The American Revolution. Was the American Revolution an act of rebellion against God and the Bible? Many today claim it was. For example, John MacArthur. He asserts, "People have mistakenly linked democracy and political freedom to Christianity. That's why many contemporary evangelicals believe the American Revolution was completely justified, both politically and scripturally. They follow the arguments of the Declaration of Independence, which declares that life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness are divinely endowed rights. But such a position is contrary to the clear teachings and commands of Romans 13, 1-7. So, the United States was actually born out of a violation of the New Testament principles, and any blessings God has bestowed on America have come in spite of that disobedience by the founding fathers." Well, I disagree with him, and I'm going to get into detail specifically on that verse and some other thoughts in the next segment, but I'm going to keep going with this. This is Wall Builders writing again. "While such charges certainly reflect the personal views of these critics, they definitely do not accurately reflect the extended theological debates that occurred at the time of the American Revolution. And the topic of civil disobedience and resistance to governing authorities had been a subject of serious theological inquiries for centuries before the Enlightenment. This was especially true during the Reformation. It was not strange that such biblical discussion should have arisen in that period. For many tyrannical civil leaders who felt personally threatened by biblical Reformation teachings attempted to suppress the spread of those teachings through bloody purges, brutal tortures, and barbaric persecutions, such as when French leaders conducted the famous St. Bartholomew's Day massacre in 1572, resulting in 110,000 Reformation followers being killed. or when Henry VIII similarly utilized public executions and burnings at the stake. In fact, those civil leaders even deliberately enacted laws specifically prohibiting Reformation adherents from practicing their scriptural beliefs. Facing such civic opposition, Reformation leaders turned to the Bible and found much guidance on the subject of civil disobedience and resistance to tyrannical civil authority. In fact, numerous famous heroes of the Bible, including many of those listed in the Faith Hall of Fame in Hebrews 11, as well as in other passages, were accorded their special position of honor because they committed civil disobedience. For example, Daniel, the three Hebrew children, the Hebrew midwives, Rahab, Moses, etc. And the apostles in Acts 4 and 5 also declared their willingness to be civilly disobedient against tyrannical commands of civil and religious rulers. In 1644, at the time of unlimited monarchies, where the king was the absolute law, Scottish theologian Samuel Rutherford penned the important theological work Lex Rex, demonstrating that the law is king rather than vice versa. For asserting that biblical position, Rutherford was eventually charged by British monarchy with high treason, but died before he could be tried. Not surprisingly, Lex Rex was banned by the crown, and every person who had a copy was ordered to turn it in to the king's official. James II continued the persecution of believers, and not surprisingly, the theological debates also continued. Significantly, the many theological writings penned during these brutal and tyrannical reigns provided the underpinning of the Glorious Revolution of 1688, in which tyrannical monarchs were set aside. England made its first attempts to separate state from church, and thus end religious tyranny and murders wrongly committed in the name of Christ. And representative government was instituted under William of Orange, when British autocratic tyranny began to increase toward America preceding the Revolution. Those ancient theological debates were renewed. Presbyterians, Lutherans, Baptists, Congregationalists, and most other denominations of that day adopted the theological viewpoint presented by Luther, Calvin, Zwingli, Rutherford, Poinet, and others. On the basis of those numerous historic theological writings, which significantly had also been regularly preached from American pulpits for decades prior to the American Revolution, Americans embraced two specific theological positions that guided their thinking and conduct in the conflict with Great Britain. The first was that most Christian denominations during the founding era held that while they were forbidden to overthrow the institution of government and live in anarchy, they were not required blindly to submit to every law and policy. Those in the founding era understood that the general institution of government was unequivocally ordained by God and was not to be overthrown. But that did not mean that God approved every specific government. God had ordained government in lieu of anarchy. He opposed anarchy, rebellion, lawlessness, and wickedness, and wanted civil government in society. Therefore, a crucial determination in the colonists' biblical exegesis was whether opposition to authority was simply to resist the general institution of government, an institution ordained by God himself, or whether it was instead to resist tyrannical leaders who had themselves rebelled against God. That the founders held the view that the institution of government is not to be opposed, but that tyranny is a position clearly evident in their writings. Samuel Adams, the father of the American Revolution and signer of the Declaration of Independence, specifically recommended a study of scriptures in order to understand the basis of America's struggle against a tyrannical king, explaining that the rights of the colonists as Christians may be best understood by reading and carefully studying the institutes of the great lawgiver and head of the Christian church, which are to be found clearly written and promulgated in the New Testament. The founders clearly believed that they were not in rebellion to God's ordained institution of civil government. They were only resisting tyranny and not the institution itself. In fact, Reverend Jacob argued from the Bible in favor of the American position, explaining, "Inasmuch as rulers are in fact servants of the public and appointed for no other purpose than to be a terror to evildoers and praise to them that do well," Romans 13, "whenever this divine order is inverted, whenever these rulers abuse their sacred trust by unrighteous attempts to injure, oppress, and enslave those very persons from whom alone, under God, their power is derived, does not humanity, does not reason, does not Scripture call upon the man, the citizen, the Christian of such a community to stand fast in that liberty wherewith Christ hath made them free? Galatians 5:1. The apostle enjoins us to submit to every ordinance of man for the Lord's sake, but surely a submission to unrighteous ordinances of unrighteous men cannot be for the Lord's sake, for he loveth righteousness, and his countenance beholds the things that are just. And this is a viewpoint I've held for a long time, that, and I'll talk about this when I talk about Romans 13, but governments are instituted to do good. And when they're not doing good, they're no longer doing what they're instituted to do. And we don't have to obey that. We can't say, well, we're not going to have government, we want anarchy. That's not biblical. But we can absolutely stand on the truth that we cannot be expected to let a tank just drive over us. Oh, well, they're the government. Reflective of the founding fathers' belief that they were not rebelling against God or resisting ordained government, but only tyranny, was the fact that the first national motto proposed for America in August 1776 was, you've heard this before, rebellion to tyrants is obedience to God. Founding Father James Wilson, a signer of both the Declaration and the Constitution, and an original justice of the U.S. Supreme Court, affirmed, the defense of oneself is not, nor can it be, abrogated by any regulation of municipal law. This principle of defense is not confined merely to a person. It extends to the liberty and to the property of a man. It is not confined merely to his own person. It extends to the persons of all those to whom he bears a peculiar relation, of his wife, of his parent, of his child. As a man is justified in defending, so he is justified in retaking his property. Man does not exist for the sake of government, but government is instituted for the sake of man. We'll read that again. Man does not exist for the sake of government, but government is instituted for the sake of man. According to the founders' biblical understanding, the fact that they were engaged in a defensive action made all the difference. They believed that they could boldly approach God and sincerely seek his aid and blessing in such a situation. In fact, so cognizant were the American leaders that they would account to God for their actions, and so convinced were they that they would be held innocent before him, that the flag of the Massachusetts Army proclaimed an appeal to God, and a flag of the Massachusetts Navy likewise declared an appeal to heaven. The Continental Congress also issued a manifesto reflecting a similar tone of submission to God. We therefore, the Congress of the United States of America, do solemnly declare that, and proclaim that, we appeal to the God who searcheth the hearts of men for the rectitude of our intentions, and in his holy presence declare that, as we are not moved by any light or hasty suggestions of anger or revenge, so, through every possible change of fortune, we will adhere to this, our determination. Significantly, the Americans had been militarily attacked for well over 2 years before they finally announced the separation. And for 11 years preceding that announcement, from 1765 to 1776, they had diligently pursued reconciliation and not conflict, offering documents such as their famous appeal of 1775 and the May 1776 Olive Branch Petition, each of which was submitted in a completely submissive and conciliatory tone.
I remind Mr. Rutledge and Mr. Duane that blood has been shed, Massachusetts blood. While we debate, our militia is left without munitions, without arms, without even the slightest encouragement.
Mr. Dickinson of Pennsylvania.
One colony cannot be allowed to take its sister colonies headlong into the maelstrom of war. Parliament will be eager to call a halt to hostilities, as are we. They will seek conciliation. We must offer them an olive branch. I move this assembly consider a humble and dutiful petition be dispatched to His Majesty, one that includes a plain statement that the colony desires immediate negotiation and accommodation of these unhappy disputes, and that we are willing to enter into measures to achieve that reconciliation. Second.
Mr. Dickinson.
The time for negotiation is past. The actions of the British Army at Lexington and Concord speak plainly enough. If we wish to regain our natural-born rights as Englishmen, then we must fight for them.
I have looked for our rights in the laws of nature and can find them only in the laws of political society. I have looked for our rights in the constitution of the English government and found them there. Our rights have been violated, Mr. Adams. That is beyond dispute. We must provide a plan to convince Parliament to restore those rights. Yeah, yeah. Do we wish to become aliens to the mother country?
No.
No! No, gentlemen. We must come to terms with the mother country. No doubt the same ship which carries forth our list of grievances will bring back their redress.
Yeah. Mr. Dickinson.
My wife and young children live on the main road to Boston, fewer than 5 miles from the full might of the British Empire.
Should they sit and wait for Gage and his savages to rob them of their home, their possessions, their very lives? No, sir. Powder and artillery are the surest and most infallible conciliatory measures we can adopt.
Possibility of peace, Mr. Adams, then I tell you no. You will have blood on your hands.
And I tell you, Mr. Dickinson, that to hold out an olive branch to Britain is a measure of gross imbecility.
If you New England men continue to oppose our measures of reconciliation, you will leave us no choice but to break off from you entirely and carry on the opposition in our own way.
I sit in judgment on no man's religion, Mr. Dickinson. But your Quaker sensibilities do us a gross disservice, sir.
It is one thing to turn the other cheek, but to lie down on the ground like a snake and crawl toward the seat of power in abject surrender. Well, that is quite another thing, sir. And I have no stomach for, sir.
Mr. Adams.
No stomach at all.
We will exhaust all peaceful approaches, Mr. Adams. And we will do it with or without the approbation of you and your Boston insurrectionists.
Hear, hear!
Mr. Dickinson's motion to send an olive branch petition to His Majesty has been made and seconded. We shall proceed to a vote.
What's interesting about that clip from the movie miniseries, John Adams, is the interaction between the mindset of the pseudo-Quakers or Quakers. Dickinson wasn't really a Quaker, but he married one. And the others. it was that back and forth that kind of set the stage. John Adams is a great series. You absolutely, if you haven't seen it, should watch that. Let's look at the legal justification here. The writers write, significantly, as the Reverend Dr. John Witherspoon, also a signer of the Declaration, also affirmed, on the part of America, there was not the most distant thought of subverting the government or of hurting the interests of the people of Great Britain, but of defending their own privileges from an unjust encroachment. There was not the least desire of withdrawing their allegiance from the common sovereign, King George, till it became absolutely necessary. And indeed, it was his own choice. Significantly, as Dr. Witherspoon had correctly noted, it was Great Britain who had terminated their entreaties. In fact, during the last 2 years of America's appeals, her peaceful pleas were directly met by armed military force. King George dispatched 25,000 British troops to invade his own colonies, enter the homes of his own citizens, to take their private possessions and goods, and imprison them without trials, all in violation of his own British common law, English Bill of Rights, and the Magna Carta, a centuries-old document that formed the basis of the covenant between British rulers and citizens. Only when those government covenants had been broken by their rulers and America had been directly attacked did America respond in self-defense. On the basis of these two theological understandings, that God himself had ordained the institution of civil government, and that God had explicitly authorized civil self-defense, the Founding Fathers and the majority of American Christians in that day believed that they were conducting themselves in a manner that was not in rebellion to God or the Scriptures. So there you have it. That is the case for rebellion of this country, how this country was formed. And you can look at the lens of the Declaration of Independence. Governments derive their just powers from the consent of the governed. They do not possess unjust powers. They do not possess the power to take away your liberty in total contravention to the Constitution. They don't. They do not possess those powers. Even though they're doing it, they don't possess it. Look at Governor Northam. He has no authority to ban guns from the Capitol, which he's just done. They're supposed to learn from history. Democrats don't like history. That's why they want to take down statues and abolish everything they can about the greatness of this country and about the greatness of the state of Virginia. They hate you. They hate me. They hate everything about what we stand for. So that is kind of a mix between, it was more over a viewpoint of what the founders and the generation looked at as far as civil disobedience. As far as, is it just to throw off the shackles of tyranny? The founders' conclusion was, yes, it was. Now let's continue with what does the Bible say? So we have cases of, as I read in there, of all kinds of rebellion throughout the Bible. Did David rebel against King Saul? Yes. Did Moses rebel against Pharaoh? Yes. He rebelled against Pharaoh. How about Elijah against the prophets of Baal? Yep. Did and they were the essentially the governing body. How about Rahab rebel against her government when it was accounted as good to her when she let the spies into her city? Did Jesus rebel? Yes. He was against the government of the day. The Jews had no king, and it was illegal for them to have one, and Jesus said he was the king of the Jews. Well, I am, is what he said. And in that two-word statement, he was claiming to be the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. So he was not only rebelling against Rome as well, you know, the government. Did Jesus rebel against the rulers of the temple when he made a whip with his own hands and used violence to drive out the money changers and cheats from the temple? Did he rebel when he told his disciples to buy a sword, something that was questionably legal at the time? Well, what about Romans 13, you say? Well, let's read it from the English Standard Version. It just happens to be the version that's on my desk here. Romans 13, verse 1 to 7. Let every person be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and those that exist have been instituted by God. Therefore, whoever resists the authorities resists what God has appointed, and those that resist will incur judgment. For rulers are not a terror to good conduct, but to bad. Would you have no fear of the one who is in authority? Then do what is good, and you will receive his approval, for he is God's servant for your good. But if you do wrong, be afraid, for he does not bear the sword in vain. For he is the servant of God, an avenger who carries out God's wrath on the wrongdoer. Therefore, one must be in subjection, not only to avoid God's wrath, but also for the sake of conscience. For because of this, you also pay taxes, for the authorities are ministers of God attending to this very thing. Pay to all what is owed to them, taxes to whom taxes are owed, revenue to whom revenue is owed, respect to whom respect is owed, and honor to whom honor is owed. Okay, let's go back up to verse 4. For he is God's servant for your, what? What was the word? Good. It was for good. That is why God institutes government. To be good. When it's not being good, it's not doing what it was instituted to do. That's the whole concept of the doctrine of the lesser magistrate, which I'll talk about in a little bit. But that was the founder's viewpoint. Our government is no longer doing good. They're doing evil upon us. They're not doing what God has created them to do. We don't want no government. I don't want no government. For one, it's not biblical, and two, it's not possible. I'm sorry, it's not. And for my libertarian listeners, I'm sorry, voluntarism, it's a neat idea. It totally discounts man's human nature, which is to step on the neck of his neighbor. Sorry, but that's what it is. There's another one here. For he is the servant of God, an avenger who carries out God's wrath on the wrongdoer. Well, in this case, they've flipped everything on their head. The Democrats up in Richmond, they're the wrongdoers. Earlier in Romans 12:18, Paul writes, "If possible, so far as it depends on you, live at peace with all." Another translations I've seen, live at peace with one another. It's hard because the Bible does not talk a lot about this thing. The Bible is not an instruction manual for government. But let me ask you a question. If you've read the Bible, do you see liberty in there or tyranny? Do you see love or do you see authoritarianism? Because I see liberty and I see love. I do not see authoritarianism or totalitarianism. I don't see those things there. I see those in society. I see those in our current legislature and our governor. I just don't see that in anywhere that I read that God is expecting you when they're kicking down their door to murder you, that you should just go, well, they are the government. I should just do what they say. Or, well, you know, they got tanks rolling down the street and darn it, they're going to run right over me and my family. That is not being a servant for your good. That is certainly not serving God any more than he would tolerate that from you doing that to someone else. To put simply, so far as it depends on you, live at peace with all. There are other verses that are confusing, but Romans 13 seems to be the go-to standby. When somebody wants you to be subjugated to government, they pull this out and they say, hey, here's this. Christianity, when it first started, when this was written, was a new thing. So we can't know for sure with 100% certainty. We're not supposed to lay down and let the tanks roll over us. Or can we? I'll let you decide. That's something you're going to have to decide for yourself. But I would say this. Be it fervent in your belief of duty to rebel as you have a duty to save lost souls. I think our society in general would be a whole lot better off if we cared as much about our lost friends and neighbors as we do care about overthrowing tyrannical scumbags. Next is from actually a website called lessermagistrate.com. The Doctrine of the Lesser Magistrate teaches that when a superior or high-ranking civil authority makes immoral or unjust laws or policies, the lower or lesser-ranking civil authority has both a right and a duty to refuse obedience to that superior authority. If necessary, the lesser authority may even actively resist the higher authority. God has established four realms of government to which he delegates authority, and they are self-government, family government, church government, and civil government. Each has its own role, function, and jurisdiction. The authority an individual possesses in any one of those four realms of government is delegated authority. In other words, they derive their authority from God. Their authority is not autonomous or unconditional. Their authority is God-given, and thus they have a duty to govern in accordance with his rule. When someone in authority makes laws or decrees contrary to God's law, they are in rebellion to God's rule. Those under their authority are not to obey them when they do this. You must pay taxes. Well, where's the authority to pay taxes? Because I said so. Shut up. Well, it doesn't work like that either. So it's just this a very simple concept, and this actually started way, way, way back at the time of the Reformation. The Reformation is where the reformers were looking at the Bible and translating it into English. and doing other things like that. And John Calvin and his followers were one of the first ones to come up with this concept, the lesser magistrate. Because in their day, they were actually breaking the rules. They were breaking the authorities were saying, hey, you can't do this. And they were doing it. God says, we need to do this. And they believed and they were doing it. Next is from Monticello.org. It's about Thomas Jefferson. This is directly quoted from him. It was to James Madison, who was in Paris in 1787. Societies exist under three forms sufficiently distinguishable. Without government, as among our Indians, under governments wherein the will of every one has just influence, as in the case of England in a slight degree, and in our states in a great one, under governments of force, as is the case of all monarchies and most other republics. To have an idea of the curse of existence under these last, they must be seen. It is a government of wolves over sheep. It is a problem, not clear in my mind, that the first condition is not the best, but I believe it to be inconsistent with any great degree of population. The second state has a great deal of good in it. The mass of mankind under that enjoys a precious degree of liberty and happiness. It has its evils, too, the principle of which is turbulence to which it is subject. But weigh this against the oppressions of monarchies, and it becomes nothing. Malo periculosum libertatum quam quietum servitutum. And that's translated, I prefer dangerous freedom over peaceful slavery. Even this evil is productive of good. It prevents the degeneracy of government and nourishes a general attention to the public affairs. I hold it that a little rebellion now and then is a good thing, and as necessary in the political world as storms in the physical. Unsuccessful rebellions indeed generally establish the encroachments on the rights of the people which have produced them. An observation of this truth should render honest Republican governors so mild in their punishment of rebellions as not to discourage them too much. It is a medicine necessary for the sound health of government. I like that one. A medicine necessary for the sound health of government. Rebellion. That'd make a good slogan for a shirt. Here's a couple things I underlined. Under governments of force, as in the case of all other monarchies and in the case and in most of the other republics. Well, that's us. We're actually between number two and number three. So we have what we're supposed to have is under government where the will of everyone has a just influence. However, that's just democracy, and democracies are terrible. What we're supposed to have is a republic. But what we're seeing right now is encroachment. Where he says, talking about that number two, where essentially a democracy, or even if we properly had a republic, it has its evils too, the principle of which is turbulence to which it is subject. And it is a turbulent thing. This is a great quote. I have to reiterate. I hold it that a little rebellion now and then is a good thing and as necessary in the political world as storms in the physical. But here's what you need to listen to real closely. Of all the things I just read, this is the most important. Unsuccessful rebellions indeed generally establish the encroachments on the rights of the people which have produced them. So those encroachments that they're trying to encroach on us right now in Richmond, if we rebel and don't do it right, if we blow it, then it will just be established. Right now, everything we say about them is coming true. All the evil that we say about them is true. What we say about how they're encroaching on our liberty and how they're trying to take our guns, it's true. They further every day are giving us more cause for it to be true. If we push back and we don't do it right, we will blow it. And we have to do this right. Whether that's the militias, militia ordinances, militia formings, musters, whatever it takes. We have to do this right. We have to win it. So if we look back, we've got the founders' justification for rebellion. We've got, I think, a good biblical case for rebellion, which we saw over and over again. You see it over and over again. I don't think rebellion for rebellion's sake. However, I think just as the founders believed that it was a necessary thing. and it was a defensive action. We also have the concept of the lesser magistrate, that it is our duty as people to not obey those in positions of authority who are being tyrannical. I'll also add this to finally wrap this section up. You are sovereign. You are. Not the representatives in Richmond. Not this jerk governor that we've got. He's not your ruler. He's not at all your ruler. He's supposed to be your representative. And it's time for us to remember that. We are the kings and queens of this country. Not these jerks that somehow get up and get elected and do what they're doing right now. Not these people in Washington who have no respect for the Constitution and that, you know, hold it up in a little booklet and say, you know, I'm doing this for the Constitution. What a joke. I think it's time for people to start pushing back. So I hope you found that section interesting and enlightening. And if you think I'm wrong, I'd love to know where you think I'm wrong. If you think I didn't add something that I should have added, love to see the comments, whether it's Facebook or on the website, or shoot me an email. Now let's talk about the news. The news. This is from WUSA 9, Richmond, Virginia. Governor Ralph Northam declared a state of emergency Wednesday afternoon ahead of Monday's gun rights rally at the state capitol. He said there are credible threats of a Charlottesville-style violence that could repeat at the Capitol grounds on Monday. He also said that credible intelligence reveals white extremist militia groups plan to enact violence during the rally. Potential threats include weaponizing drones above the state capitol and storming the Capitol grounds, Northam said Wednesday. No one wants another incident like we saw in Charlottesville in 2017. We will not allow that mayhem and violence to happen here, Northam said. The governor urged all unnecessary personnel to stay out of Richmond Monday out of an abundance of caution. Access will be restricted in and out of the Capitol Square, officials said. Governor has prohibited all weapons, including firearms, from Capitol grounds. So he's expanded under this supposed emergency power that he doesn't possess. He has expanded the reach of where you can't have guns. Specifically, if you were to look at the Capitol grounds, what you'll see is you'll see the Pocahontas building on the bottom, this legislature building in the middle, and the governor's mansion, I believe, is off to the right, and they're rebuilding the legislative offices up at the top. Basically, they're going to put a giant fence around this thing, and they're probably going to be screening for guns, whether that's, well, obviously, if you're carrying a rifle like I'll be, you're not getting in. But what they're going to be doing is probably have magnetometers or wands or something. They're not going to allow backpacks, or they'll be searching backpacks. I don't know what they're going to be doing. But I can tell you that that will impact who actually gets to go in. Because guess who's not going in without his gun? This guy. Guess who's not going back 10 blocks away to his vehicle? I'll be there. I'm not leaving. But it'll change the equation. It actually will make it safer for those gun owners attending, because you won't be getting scoped by sniper rifles from the many alphabet agencies that are going to be set up on rooftops around the area. So, probably not so bad. But in any case, we'll see how long it lasts before. I mean, it just really depends. I mean, hey, look, none of us is going up there with violence on our mind. But make no mistake, we'll meet it. If you want to bring it, we'll meet it. So, I guess it'll depend on who else shows up. But this is nonsense. This is white supremacists, you know. It's like, what did it say? Extremist groups. White extremist militia groups. I doubt very much that we'll have that there. If you see that there, a bunch of guys walking around with, you know, white power stuff, I'll about guarantee those guys are Antifa. And true to form, the latest news today that just popped out was that they arrested three white supremacist extremists, add your descriptor here, up in Maryland. They were planning on coming to the lobby day stuff. And, well, you know, the FBI, they love to come up with people that are bad. My guess is that these guys, whoever they are, had somebody planted inside with them. That's what the FBI likes to do. So that's why I've said in the past, know who you're teaming up with. Know them. Actually, you know them. And finally, in the news section, these are the bills I had mentioned earlier. SB 399, Virginia's Electoral College votes to be awarded to the winner of the national popular vote. SJ 29, the governor to be elected by a majority of votes in congressional districts, not by statewide majority. SJ 14, restores voting rights to convicted felons. SJ 8, allows felons and those declared mentally incompetent to vote. SB 65, eliminates photo ID requirement for voting. SJ 6, increases the term limit of the governor from 4 to 8 years. So currently in Virginia, you can only be governor for one term. So check those out. It's SB 399, SJ 29, SJ 14, SJ 8, SJ 6. So let's talk about Lobby Day. One of the other things in the news today was that VCDL and Gun Owners of America, they filed a legal attempt to get an injunction against this Executive Order 49. That's the one where Governor Northam has expanded the reach of the no guns rules. But surprise, surprise, the circuit court denied their request. So they've applied for an emergency appeal, and I appreciate the work that they're doing, but you all have to understand that we're not going to solve this problem in the courts, and we're not going to solve it legislatively. There's very few ways left for us to solve it. Jury nullification's one. Most people don't even know what that is. And then, of course, armed resistance is another. But there is no political solution to the problem we're facing right now, and there's no judicial solution. If there was a judicial solution to this problem, we would have found it a while ago when California passed the laws, and then Colorado passed the laws, and then, you know, New York and Connecticut and New Jersey, and I've talked about this list before. All these places. No court has stopped them. There's been no magic case that stopped them. And when there is a case like Heller that absolutely affirms an individual's right to keep and bear arms, it doesn't matter. You're not able to carry guns in D.C., and yet that's what the whole case was about. So if you think that solving it in the courts is going to solve your problems, not going to happen. So Lobby Day, you're going up to Lobby Day. I'm going to Lobby Day. I always go to Lobby Day. Some of you want to go up and you want to actually try and lobby these people because you think it's going to make a difference. I don't personally, but good for you for trying. I've done that many years. I've gone up, lived in Virginia about 11 years. I've only missed two, and I had a cold on one, and I was out of the state on another, I believe. And I've always gone up, and I've always talked to the representatives, or mostly their aides. But this new crop that's up there, these Democrats, they don't care what you think. They never really cared what you thought, but they were in the minority, so they were pretty irrelevant. They do not care what you think. And on top of that, you have to go in unarmed. So have a designated defender, as what VCDL is suggesting, is that you go with a group and that you have some designated defenders that stay outside and you go in. I'll be holding the pistol for a friend as he goes in, and he'll be picking that back up from me when he comes out. But you're at the mercy of the state police or the Capitol Police protecting you, assuming that they do their jobs. You're completely defenseless if Antifa's up there causing problems, because they'll be on the outside and they'll be armed. I guarantee you they'll be armed. They never get to, Seattle? They're not armed there. They had sticks. They'd beat people. I would say this, if you are even considering bringing your young person up there, your child, what has gotten into your head? Knock it off. Don't even think about doing that. Unless your young person is squared away, high speed, and is a competitive shooter and can defend themselves. And even then, I couldn't imagine bringing my teenagers up there and if something had happened to them. So this is not something to bring your your child to, so that they can experience what government and standing up for your rights is about. Not at all. I mean, in years past, I have brought them to things like this. But I wouldn't even let them anywhere near the state capitol on Monday. No way. So some other considerations to think about is there's going to be a lot of road closures. And right now, as it stands, if you were to look at a map, and the best place to go is VCDL, Virginia Citizens Defense League. Either go to their Facebook page and get on their alerts. They have an alert that they send out. It's all gun related. And they send out stuff all the time. Good stuff. You want to definitely get on the alerts. There is some really good infographics that they've got of where the closures are, where the entrances are if you're going to go in. Basically, they take the grassy area, if you were to look at the map, put a fence all the way around that. All the streets around that will be closed and to driving traffic, which I'm actually glad about. Because if you're going to have a false flag, the best one to have would be, what, a truck bomb or something like that. Well, now they won't be able to have anybody driving or parking anywhere around there. So that's a good thing. But be advised, there's only one entrance and I think four or five exits to that area. So plan ahead. What you need to do is, one, you should go as a team of 2 to 4 to 6 to 10 people. You should have a plan to get out of there quickly if you have to. Now, I know parking is going to be a challenge. You'll probably be parked anywhere from 5 to 10 blocks away from your vehicle. And I would not advise leaving anything that you don't want to get stolen out of your car. Prime opportunity for criminals to break into cars and get some nice guns. So I'd highly recommend you carry that with you. But you should have multiple exit routes planned out ahead of time. Get a map, draw them out, write them out, whatever. Don't rely on your cell phone. Who knows what that'll be like? If there's 100,000 people, just crazy, but hey, what if there is? 100,000 people all trying to use their cell phones. The system's going to be overloaded and it's not going to work right. If you're taking a bus up, be prepared to be patient as those buses have to navigate this chaos. Have a plan of where you're going to rally with your team and have exit routes already planned out for different freeways and whatnot. Richmond is a little bit of a goofy place as far as how it's laid out and how to get to the freeways. So you really have to have that planned out in your head ahead of time. Number one, be safe and keep a cool head. I think it is very possible that something could go down. And if it does, the blame falls 100% on the head of the Democrats in the Virginia legislature and on the head of the baby-killing, blackface governor, Northam. 100%, because none of this would be happening. This would be a normal lobby day with a couple thousand people, and that would be it. But he has continued to pour gasoline on the fire. It's insane. Be safe, patriots. Just please understand what you're getting into. The Bible says, Jesus said in Matthew, if you live by the sword, you will die by the sword. Now, I don't think that was a command telling us not to live by the sword. I think that was Jesus telling us, you better understand something. If you're going to pick up this sword, that it's very possible you could die by it. You have to understand and count that cost and know what the end result's going to be if you do that. Count the cost. Also, make sure that if you're going up there, you have an IFAC. For if you don't know, an IFAC is an individual first aid kit. Most surplus places have them. I personally like the Marine Corps' IFACs. I think they're really well outfitted. And you can usually find, if you're allowed to look inside them and cherry pick, you can find some that have quick clot that's not expired or other cool things in those kits. But a tourniquet, or multiple tourniquets, Israeli bandages, things like that, that could really come in handy for you and your team or others that didn't come prepared. So just plan ahead. There are options if you don't want to go in the Capitol grounds, and that's lots of streets and lots of places around there. I would love to see total gridlock. I would love to see, and I mean by people gridlock, so that the legislators can't even get out of the building and move to the legislative body. There's the Pocahontas building, and it's about a block and a half away from where the legislators meet. And if it's jam-packed with people, they can't go. It's almost like getting through a gauntlet. Nothing gets done that day. And yeah, it's a small victory, but it's a victory. Well, Patriots, that's it for this episode of Radio Free Virginia. This is Hank Reardon wishing you a wonderful weekend, and hopefully you'll have a safe week, and we'll all have a safe lobby day on Monday. God bless you.